this week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
Kennedy's somewhat unique. His initial speech called the Democratic Party out for becoming the party of fear, pharma, censorship, and war. And he very eloquently laid out that a huge problem of our time is the collusion between government power and corporate power.
Independent journalist Sam Husseini looks at the candidacy of Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
There's a united front, not just of the Hollywood labor unions, but of the non-union workers as well, and of the unions all across America. As you can see here, we're standing shoulder to shoulder.
Tech workers rally at Apple headquarters in solidarity with striking writers.
A full-scale propaganda war is being conducted against U.S. and NATO populations to create compliance and acceptance of their rulers' policies in support of its Ukrainian military proxy to fight and damage Russia as much as possible.
And some truths about U.S. and NATO propaganda about Ukraine. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. The 2024 presidential campaigns have already begun in the U.S., and while the Republican candidates are getting free media publicity on CNN and MSNBC, there has been little press coverage of any Democratic Party candidates besides incumbent Joe Biden. Independent journalist Sam Husseini spoke to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer about Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s candidacy.
He's running in the Democratic Party, which has caused some consternation among his supporters. There was a legal case, and this applies not just to Robert Kennedy Jr., but to every Democratic candidate or anybody who contemplates running in the Democratic Party. There was a lawsuit done by supporters of Bernie Sanders in 2016, saying that the Democratic Party rigged the primaries against Bernie Sanders. It went to court, and the Democratic Party's lawyers said, look, we can do whatever the heck we want. We could pick the nominee in the smoke-filled back room like we used to. It's our candy store, and that's that. And they won. By law, the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, can make whoever they want the nominee. So one sort of obvious critique of Kennedy and anybody else who runs within the Democratic Party is that you're just simply sort of fueling a process when the establishment is going to get to pick the nominee at the end, and what's been called sheepdogging. I mean, there's a long line of this, you know, from Jesse Jackson to Kucinich to Bernie Sanders and so on, of people who sort of seem to give some hope to the left, but in the final analysis, it's been argued they basically just put put the supporters back into the Democratic Party. Kennedy's somewhat unique in that he isn't just what you would typically think of as a leftist. I mean, he's made his name most prominently recently by his skepticism of vaccines, and something that I've done work in. He's done some work regarding COVID origins, and much of the left, the liberals, and so on, dismissed the possibility of lab origins. I've argued for the last 3 years that this was a catastrophic error, and that effectively a lot of this work that's done in labs is de facto biowarfare. He gets at some of that. He certainly hasn't raised it to the extent that I would expect in his presidential run so far. He's been idiosyncratic. He's highlighted his environmental work with the water keepers, and the other day he went to the border, to the Mexican border, to highlight what he seemed to think was a huge problem of lots of people going over the border, seeming that this was going to be a major priority of his.
Well, so, one of the issues he has raised is the role of the pharmaceutical industry.
Absolutely.
CDC, and one of the reasons people don't really trust the CDC and government agencies is because of the influence of big pharma.
Absolutely. I should say, I mean, I had some qualms with it, but his initial speech, which was a month or two ago, and he was introduced by Dennis Kucinich, who's his campaign manager, you know, called the Democratic Party out for becoming the party of fear, pharma, censorship, and war. And he very eloquently laid out that a huge problem of our time is the collusion between government power and corporate power. in realm after realm. I thought that he raised a lot of great points in that speech. It was one of the few political speeches I've heard where I actually felt I learned something from.
The corporate capture of government agencies, not just the CDC, but OSHA has been captured by the corporations. Many, many agencies have been captured by the corporations are supposed to regulate, but I don't know what his solution is. For example, how do you get the pharmaceutical industry out of the government? Since it's basically captured the government by supported both by the Democrats and Republicans who support these executives and get money from them.
Yeah, he's been kind of vague from what I've heard. I mean, he says stuff like, I'm a lawyer, I've sued these agencies, I know how they work, I know how to fix it, which I don't doubt that he has some insights as a result of that. He has, you know, successfully, you know, done a lot of legal actions against the EPA, for example, or against polluters. But I have not seen exactly how he's going to accomplish what he says he's going to accomplish as yet.
The coverage of his campaign, I mean, actually, I learned of what was going on in New Hampshire from Fox News.
Yeah.
I mean, that is the state of the corporate media in this country. You have to learn about the Democratic Party and their candidates on Fox News, and they have debates of the Republicans. They're profiling Trump and all the Republicans, yet they're not interested, it seems, in profiling Robert F. Kennedy or other candidates who are running in the Democratic primary. Do you find that strange or part of what's going on?
I find it noteworthy, but I find it there's a clear explanation for it. You know, the establishment, you know, liberals and progressives don't want any scrutiny towards Biden, and they want this to be a coronation. And it's not just the corporate media. I mean, I've written several pieces on the Kennedy's campaign. One of them I actually did a search on. You know, I talked about how media are dismissing him or demonizing him or caricaturizing him, caricaturing him. Democracy Now! Hadn't noted that he is running, which is kind of remarkable. He used to be a, you know, somewhat regular and revered guest on Democracy Now! So it's not just the establishment media that's acting that way. I mean, you know, Fox and company, you know, it's in their interest to want a fight on the Democratic side. So they have an ulterior motive, but they are actually providing information.
And he's getting like 20% on some of these surveys. In New Hampshire, he could be a candidate. I mean, that would be, would that force the Democratic Party to allow a debate if a candidate won New Hampshire?
Well, they've indicated that they don't want a debate, and they've also made it so that they are making or trying to make South Carolina the first primary. I think that this was in part to head off the possibility of what could happen here. Kennedy, especially in New England, could win or, you know, have a very strong showing in a, you know, in a New Hampshire primary. And that could be incredibly embarrassing for Biden. And it has, by the way, an incredible historical parallel, as you might be aware, Steve, with 1968. Lyndon Johnson was embarrassed in the New Hampshire primary by Eugene McCarthy. And that led the way for Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s father, Robert Kennedy, entering the race and seemed on a path to win until he was assassinated. So, you know, the possibility of a shocking upset in New Hampshire seems to be something that the Democratic Party sought to avoid. And so they've made South Carolina, or trying to make South Carolina, the first primary.
And also the union leadership of the United States, the SEIU, are telling their members they should go for Biden. They don't want a left candidate. They don't want a debate in the Democratic Party, which means that the media, all the media, is being aimed at the Republicans. Republicans are getting their voices out, Republican issues, Republican program. Every day you see Republicans.
That's a great point. That's a great point. That is a recipe for them dominating the conversation so that people dwell on the differences or alleged differences between DeSantis and Trump and God knows who else. And meanwhile, it's just taken for granted that Biden is the best that could be accomplished from a progressive point of view. I think it's completely scandalous, and it leads to more brain deadness, to be totally honest with you.
Well, not to have a debate on the election confirms the Biden monopoly, you know, the kind of control of the whole election process in the United States, that they don't want an alternative party. They don't want alternative points of view. It's either Republicans or Biden, whoever that is. And If Trump is the candidate, Trump against Biden. That's the choice they want the American people to have in 2024, which is very dangerous, very dangerous.
Yeah, and it ends up not being a choice because, you know, in significant part, you end up not having anybody voting for anybody. They're just voting against. It's a hate and fear driven system, you know. So it shuts down people's brains. They become incapable of scrutinizing Biden because all they can see is, oh my God, it might be Trump. So
that is part of the plan.
Yeah,
you did raise an issue about his backtracking on supporting Roger Waters, the musician, mm-hmm. who supported the Palestinians. Why don't you talk about that? And you wrote about it and said that it was connected to who controls the Democratic Party.
Yeah, those are both certainly factors. I mean, I had been questioning in my pieces on Kennedy, what's his position on Israel? And there are complicated reasons why I was questioning that. And I got my answer when he, you know, tweeted a statement of support for Roger Waters, the main songwriter for Pink Floyd, who performed parts of The Wall recently and got excoriated by the pro-Israeli lobby in a completely demented manner, claiming that he's an anti-Semite because he honored Anne Frank and performed one of his songs In the Flesh, which is a parody of a fascist demagogue that obviously denounces fascism. And Kennedy tweeted at him, you know, applauding his courage, and Roger Waters tweeted back. And then apparently Kennedy was told that Roger Waters is a critic of Israel, and Kennedy deleted the tweet and made a statement pledging fealty and everlasting support for Israel, while Kucinich, who has been critical of Israel, was sort of standing in the background with his arms crossed. So, you know, that's a real concern. It's a concern to me, especially because, I think that there are different strands of movements. And I think that there was a great deal of propaganda around the pandemic, in particular, around the question of origins. That's the question that I've focused on for much of the last 3 years. And there's also the question of U.S. imperial foreign policy. And the way that this is shaking down is sort of to put those things at odds. And I don't think that they should be put at odds. There are two strands of criticisms of the establishment that have a great deal in common. And so the personalities involved in the election seem to be on a course to collide those movements rather than to reinforce them.
And you also talk about the role of the Democratic Party, who controls the Democratic Party, and make some interesting points about who's really running the Democratic Party, which our unions, and I'm a union member, are supporting. Why don't you go over the operations of the Democratic Party? Who's really in charge in the Democratic Party?
Well, I'm sure that there's a more complicated question of that, but I just simply examined some of the background of this fairly young gentleman who's the chair of the Democratic National Committee, Jamie Harrison, and he used to be an aide for Jim Clyburn, who's a very influential person in Congress who basically helped ensure Biden became the nominee in 2020 by endorsing him just before the South Carolina primary. I contend in my writing that this was part of a elaborate scheme to ensure that Biden became the nominee. But Harrison's background is with the Podesta Group, and his clients there included American Coalition for Clean Coal Electricity, Bank of America, Berkshire Hathaway, Boeing, BP, Google, Lockheed Martin, National Association of Broadcasters, National Mining Association, Oracle, Walmart, Wells Fargo. This is his client list. This is what has apparently made him millions of dollars. So, you know, there are all kinds of mechanisms that are leading to corporate and wealth control of the Democratic Party by wealthy elites. And the leadership of the Democratic Party is counting on people hating Republicans more than anything else, and think that that's their path to either success or at least maintaining their power.
That was independent journalist Sam Husseini speaking to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer. Sam Husseini has been writing about the Democratic Party primary on husseini.substack.com. Hard work. That was Hard Work, a 1976 classic by John Handy. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Paulina Vasilyev. Tuesday, May 6th, was a National Day of Action to support the 11,000 striking writers of the Writers Guild of America West. At Apple headquarters in Cupertino, California, workers rallied and spoke out about their issues and were joined by tech workers, Teamsters, and construction workers.
The people united can never be defeated.
There's a united front, not just of the Hollywood labor unions, but of the non-union workers as well, and of the unions all across America. As you can see here, we're standing shoulder to shoulder in solidarity today.
The Apple workers, are they going to support this?
Oh, yeah. So the Apple retail unions, part of CWA, I'm sure they'll support it. I'm with the Alphabet workers union. We absolutely support this.
And Apple's spending a lot of money apparently fighting the union. They don't want union for the Apple.
Yep. Lots of money.
Yeah. And that's big tech, and that's Wall Street's entire deal. They would love to have a company with zero employees because that is zero overhead. It's pure profit. So that is their ultimate end goal, is to minimize the necessary requirements for human workers and to make sure that any work is done by automated systems that would keep the profits in their pockets and out of our hands.
They want to make you gig workers?
You know, when we talk about gig workers, we're not talking about it as a derogatory term. We're talking about it as a cautionary tale, because gig work used to be profitable, it used to be flexible, and it used to be the sort of job that was heaven sent to workers working minimum wage. And what happened was those workers saw their hours going up, their pay going down, until they found themselves in a predatory system they could not escape. That's been happening to all of us all over the country, and something that we are saying, we will not tolerate this any longer.
All these big tech companies, all the same things, right? They want to just make a lot more money, you know, use AI to replace workers, exploit workers further. So, yeah, I mean, it's the same whether it's Apple, Microsoft, Google. And, yeah, we are, you know, we are a campaign trying to unionize workers at Google, at its subsidiaries, its vendor companies. We recently had a group of workers who won their bargaining rights, workers at YouTube Music through a vendor company called Cognizant. So they're going to go into negotiations now. Cognizant, hey, if you're listening, negotiate with them. And yeah, we're going to keep going from there.
It's been an existential crisis. It hasn't just been happening now. This is just the latest blow to the workforce. For the last 10 years, our rooms in Hollywood, our television rooms, have been shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. They have found new ways to suppress our pay. This is just the latest attack on workers in America. So this is just the next step. This isn't even the first time it's happened. This is just the latest example of how much the tech companies and Wall Street hate having to employ human beings in their companies. AI is supposed to be a tool. AI is supposed to help us in the workplace. It's not supposed to help our employers replace us. And so if we don't put the protections in that say, if this is a tool, the rules and regulations need to be determined by the people who use them, and that is the Teamsters, that is the workers, that is the writers, we should be the only ones deciding how this tool will be used. If that is not acceptable to the companies, then we will be out here on the front lines fighting until they realize that the power needs to lie with us, not with them.
Apple, these companies are saying they're not going to release the number of streams they do of your material.
They never do.
It's proprietary?
It's par for the course. It's one of the many roadblocks that they try and throw up in order to take away our power, because that's what knowledge is. In order to have an ethical industry, you have to have transparency. And Apple, big tech companies, Apple, Amazon, all of the other studios in the AMPTP are not about transparency. We are. That's why we released our proposals and the responses from the AMPTP at the very beginning of the strike, so our members and the rest of the world could know exactly what was asked for and exactly what was said.
Some of your members have said that this is existential, that if you don't win this, you could be eliminated, the industry could be eliminated. Is that true?
That is true. It is an existential crisis because our industry is on the brink of extinction. Already, if you look at what's been going on in different areas of the industry, the VFX houses that have been shutting down because they cannot afford to work for the movies that have contracted them. If you look back to 2013, the VFX house that did Life of Pi had to declare bankruptcy because they were not paid enough. That has been happening all over, where our quotes and our wages have been undercut and pressed down so that none of us are able to make an actual sustainable living. We are looked to make this our part-time work while dedicating full-time energy and hours to these projects, and it's no longer acceptable.
Workers should have a say, you know, in their working conditions, in the pay and benefits they get, in how the things that they produce are used in the world, you know, in what the impact of their work is on everybody else around them.
That's what they're saying now about AI as well, that it's going to free people, that it's going to allow them the time to pursue their leisurely activities. But the fact of the matter is we're having AI come in and replace people, without any sort of plan for how those people are going to now make a living, how they're going to keep a roof over their head. It's not as though we're creating a utopia. We're essentially trying to keep the 99% of America unemployed, in debt, and at the mercy of big tech and Wall Street. Because once you cannot afford to leave your job, you are trapped, and they know that. So instead of paying competitive wages that would encourage the best workers and the best work to come out of their companies, they are trying to hold workers hostage by paying them as little as possible to ensure that they cannot leave.
And are you calling for a boycott or for people to cancel their subscriptions to these services?
I think that people should do whatever they feel will contribute to the union movement right now. I would love for them to come and stand with us. I would actually say if you support us, if you support the workers of Hollywood, I would greatly encourage you to make a contribution to the Entertainment Community Fund, which is an organization that has been helping our brother and sister workers who are out of work because of this strike and making sure that they have money in order to feed their families, pay their rent. We're just asking anyone who is supporting us to pay money to make a donation to the ECF in order to support our fellow brother and sister workers.
My name is Richard Cordner. Yes, I'm a writer. There's multiple issues that the WGA is striking for. The rise of mini rooms being one of them, and also the fact that like half the members of the WGA are working for guild minimums. The larger point is that corporations in the entertainment industry have never been making larger profits, billions and billions of dollars, paying their chief executives $250 million a year, and yet they're quibbling with the people who create the very content that makes them all that money. So we're sick of it, to be honest.
And the salaries of the executives are quite high that you're fighting.
$250 million last year, I think David Zaslav, the CEO of Warner Discovery, was paid. So yeah, they're pretty high. Corporations, wherever they can, are going to try and optimize, which generally means forcing workers into lower and lower working conditions. So it's something that we have to set guardrails in place for now, really, yeah.
And there's some reports of workers feeling they're gig workers. They're turned into gig workers with these smaller rooms. What's that all about?
That's exactly how writing feels at the moment. It feels like gig work. Like it used to be a pretty stable profession, a solid kind of middle class or upper middle class profession for people. And nowadays, it does sort of feel like you're working for increasingly shorter periods of times on jobs, and then you're essentially unemployed looking for the next job. So it's the very definition of gig work.
So are a lot of writers concerned that they won't have a future if they continue to do what they're doing?
Absolutely. I think this is an existential strike. I think that we have to, what we're striking for now is the future of this as a viable career.
And Goldman Sachs has said that there may be 300 million workers who lose their jobs as a result of AI. It seems like it's a broader social economic issue.
Absolutely, yeah. I think that this is the coalface for an awful lot of jobs, not just in the creative industries, but professional white-collar jobs that AI could soon be threatening. So it's important to put the guardrails in place now and do everything that we can to ensure that people are treated fairly by the companies they work for.
Steve Beck, I believe in us as a community, as a labor movement coming together no matter what. And that's why I'm here today, to support them the same way that they would support us. That's what unions are, right? We take it from the word unity. So how can you be in a union but not be unified against the real fight? These corporations are 100% hell-bent on keeping that 500% gap, right? Our job is to try to get a piece of that pie. That's it.
Those were voices of tech workers and Teamsters rallying in solidarity with the striking Writers Guild of America West.
Tesla, ain't got nowhere to go. I'm sleeping in my Tesla, ain't got nowhere to go. There's a lot of us cars and Teslas down here on Santana Road. I went down the city council, had to speak my mind. I went down the city council, I just had to speak my mind. I was looking for some answers, there was nothing there to find. Well, they ticketed my Tesla, got boots on every tie. Yeah, they ticketed my Tesla, got boots on every tie. There's a lot of us with boots on, rocking boots is catching fire.
That was Carol Denny singing Sleeping in My Tesla. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasilyev. 20-year-old Swedish environmentalist Greta Thunberg weighed in on the Ukraine war this week, tweeting, quote, "This ecocide as a continuation of Russia's unprovoked, full-scale invasion of Ukraine is yet another atrocity which leaves the world lost for words. Our eyes are once again on Russia, who must be held accountable for their crimes," end quote. Pacifica's Ann Garrison has more.
Left journalists, critical of the West's role in the Ukraine war, quickly chimed in to say that Greta Thunberg's tweet proved she has always been a psyop for powerful Western interests. Max Blumenthal and Aaron Mette criticized her tweet on Friday's Gray Zone podcast.
The fact you have this internationally known environmental activist repeating neocon propaganda about the war in Ukraine, I think says a lot. It says a lot about where we're at, it says a lot about where the left is at, where the progressive movement is at, how many people have been duped into buying into so much proxy war propaganda. What she's talking about is the bombing of the Kakhovka Dam, which of course she blames on Russia because that's what US officials and Ukrainian officials are doing. So she's just parroting that. But look at that term there, unprovoked full-scale invasion of Ukraine. That's right out of any neocon talking book. And here is Greta Thunberg.
Yeah, if you just Google that term, unprovoked full-scale invasion, you'll see that it's part of the State Department briefings and part of the Biden administration's language, that they've actually focus grouped that language, and it somehow winds up in a Greta tweet, and it just illustrates what an op she is. She was always a complete op. Like, I was just so suspicious. Who is this kid who's coming across the sea on some solar-powered boat or whatever? And then all these people are there waiting for her at Manhattan, at the harbor in Manhattan. And I'd never heard of her before. And she's here to save us. And there's a talk waiting for her at a theater in New York with Naomi Klein. It's an op. Something, there's got to be something behind this. Here it is.
This is
State Department.
Yeah, State Department. And they call, and it's for people who can't see it, they say here, unprovoked full-scale invasion of Ukraine. So somebody fed her that talking point, and it happens to exactly mirror what the State Department says about the war in Ukraine, unprovoked full-scale invasion.
And she was at Davos this year. I mean, it's just completely shameless. Like, she's meeting with the heads of industry. No one knows what meetings took place there because what she was doing was took place behind closed doors. But she is essentially a shill for powerful interests.
Speaking
always
of
had
shill,
been.
That was Max Blumenthal and Aaron Mette on Swedish environmentalist Greta Thunberg's Twitter post about the Ukraine war. In Berkeley, for Pacifica, I'm Ann Garrison.
Greta doesn't eat feta, halloumi, camembert, brie, or cheddar. And if Greta had a piece of bruschetta, there wouldn't be any mozzarella. Greta doesn't wear leather, it's getting too hot for it in this weather. And Greta doesn't buy a new sweater unless she thinks it's gonna last forever. Because Thunberg can see when the ice caps unfreeze, you can say goodbye to humanity. When we're starving in deserts and drowning in seas, COVID-19 will seem like a breezy ocean.
That was Ollie Frost singing the Greta Thunberg song. Next, Capitalism, Race, and Democracy contributor Thomas O'Rourke gives us his take on the role of propaganda in the NATO proxy war against Russia in Ukraine.
The war in Ukraine is now in its ninth year, though like many descriptions pertaining to this conflict, that is disputed. The U.S.-NATO version of this war that mirrors the Zelensky regime in Kiev says that it began in February 2022 when Russian armed forces illegally invaded Ukraine. An alternative version says that the current conflict began as a civil war between CIA-supported ultra-nationalists against Ukraine's minority populations, including Russians, Romani, Belarusians, Tartars, and others. According to this version, the ultra-nationalists overthrew the duly elected pro-Russian president, Viktor Yanukovych, in the 2014 Maidan coup. Following the coup, Russia took steps to protect both the majority Russian population as well as its strategic military interests on the Black Sea by annexing the Crimean Peninsula in March 2014. Tensions between minority communities and the central government in Kiev continued to escalate when it outlawed the use of any language but Ukrainian in schools, government, or civil service. Within months, civil war between Kiev and the majority Russian Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics was raging, with battle lines forming close to the borders of these autonomy-seeking oblasts. Several efforts at negotiations resulted in the Minsk Accords. Two versions both committed the government in Kiev to respecting its minorities legally and politically, while allowing some autonomy within the Donetsk and Luhansk oblasts. Neither agreement was ultimately honored by Kiev. Before moving on, a few words about propaganda. Historically speaking, propaganda is a coordinated set of acts and messages designed to influence the public in order to build social support and agreement with the propagandizers. Negative connotations of the word arose from post-World War I revelations of systematic manipulation and lies by both British and American governments in the service of their respective and allied war efforts. Key features of modern state or corporate-sponsored propaganda are the use of emotionally resonant, persuasive messages diffused as widely and frequently as possible via mass media. The higher the level of emotional response, the easier it is to create a binary mentality with the audience, which in turn encourages quicker and more enthusiastic responses. In the case of war propaganda, this binary mentality linked to high levels of emotion helped manipulate the public into supporting the war aims of the leadership in the government. Tropes like us versus them, good versus evil, civilization versus chaos are tried and true examples. A full-scale propaganda war is being conducted against U.S. and NATO populations to create compliance and acceptance of their rulers' policies in support of its Ukrainian military proxy to fight and damage Russia as much as possible. What follows are some specific examples of propaganda ploys and lies perpetrated by the U.S. and NATO and its Ukrainian client state and media, seeking to bolster public support for its side of the war. Time and space permit only the mention of some examples by name, with fuller explanation provided for 3 to 4 cases. Ploy number one, the Ghost of Kiev, was an early, short-lived narrative of a super competent and fierce Ukrainian fighter pilot that allegedly shot down some 40 Russian aircraft in the early days of the war before being killed in combat. No evidence for this has ever been found, with only Ukrainian government sources cited as sources. Ploy number two, the Bucha massacre of late March 2022. One of many supposed examples of Russian war crimes committed against Ukrainian civilians. Although most eyewitness testimony, as well as real-time forensic evidence, or its lack, is tightly controlled by the Ukrainian military and is still secret, the heinous killings of dozens of people in Bucha was immediately blamed on Russian troops after they pulled out of Bucha and suspended operations around the capital, Kiev. But this withholding of forensic evidence should compel objective observers to question why such evidence was covered up, and then ask why Russian forces would have committed such acts. Cui bono, to quote Lenin, Cicero, and other sages across the ages,
Who benefits is the obvious question asked in any fictional whodunit, as well as in the real world by cops, lawyers, journalists, and historians. Why would Russian forces, just prior to withdrawing from this small town outside Kiev, commit mass murder on a population that reports indicated cooperated with and even befriended the Russian soldiers occupying the area for a few weeks prior? Additionally, satellite imagery has been cited to call into question the timing of the Russians' withdrawal, the subsequent arrival of Ukrainian forces, including members of Ukraine's FSB military intelligence service, and the appearance of bodies on the streets of Bucha, many with white cloth armbands that indicated that person was sympathetic to Russia, or at least sought to coexist peacefully with Russian military forces. Retired U.S. Marine Corps Major Scott Ritter is a widely renowned commentator and author on most things military and geopolitical. He spoke to podcaster Richard Medhurst last April about his questioning of the Ukrainian government and Western media accounts of the Bucha massacre.
Before I wrote down about the Ukrainian National Police being the perpetrators of numerous crimes, I researched the subject. I dug into various images and videotapes of the dead people. I assessed it using whatever forensic evaluation that one can in something like this. You know, and I saw, for instance, that many of the bodies had the green dry ration packaging of the Russian ration box used extensively to support civilians in need. I also noticed that many of the bodies had the white armbands on that signify people who are not a threat to Russia, and that the people that didn't have the white armbands had their hands bound behind their backs using the material that looked awfully like armbands that are no longer on their shoulder. So the scene is telling me that these are pro-Russian or Russian sympathizers or people who have interacted with Russia, people who have been the benefactors of Russian humanitarian aid, and people who are heading in the direction of Russian troops. And so then you have to say, okay, who killed them? Well, I don't know by looking at that pictures, but if you're pro-Russian or Russian sympathetic, equipped with humanitarian aid provided by Russia, the odds are that the Russians didn't kill them.
The third propaganda ploy we'll examine involves the obscuring or outright denial by Western governments and media that ultra-nationalist Ukrainian fascists not only exist in considerable numbers, but also wield extraordinary influence in the Kiev government and Ukrainian state apparatus. Many reporters and chroniclers have documented the ultra-nationalist, fascistic political elements of historical and contemporary Ukraine, their growth within the context of the Civil War, and the historical links to Banderite Ukrainian and Polish fascists during World War II and its aftermath. This includes Cold War activities of Eastern European anti-communists sponsored by the CIA and other Western intelligence services aimed at the Warsaw Pact, Eastern Bloc nations. Here's an audio clip from On Demand News in a story called The Azov Battalion, Ukrainian Patriots or Neo-Nazis, published by On Demand News and posted last year.
Patriots or neo-Nazis? It's a question that offers a different answer every time it's asked. To Ukraine, the ragtag group of volunteer fighters that make up the Azov Battalion have been protecting the nation's borders in the east for close to a decade. To Russian President Vladimir Putin, their far-right politics and extremist insignia are justification to claim that Ukraine needs to be denazified. Known as one of Ukraine's toughest fighting forces, the Azov Battalion was formed in 2014 to fight pro-Russian separatists in the eastern Donbas region. The unit is made up of far-right volunteers accused of harboring neo-Nazi and white supremacist ideologies. The emblems on soldiers' uniforms feature symbols that are now associated with Nazi Germany and neo-Nazis. In 2010, the battalion's first commander and former Ukrainian politician Andriy Beletsky said Ukraine's national purpose was to lead the white supremacists of the world in a final crusade against Semite-led Untermenschen, or subhumans. 5 years later, then-spokesperson for the regiment Andriy Dychenko said that 10 to 20% of Azov's recruits were Nazis. The group has also fallen foul of the United Nations, who, in 2016, published a report accusing the battalion of raping and torturing detainees in the Donbas region. Recent footage from the conflict shows Azov fighters coating their bullets in pig fat, allegedly to be used against Chechen Muslims fighting on Russia's side. In the video, a man addresses the Chechen fighters.
Dear Muslim brothers, in our country, you will not go to heaven. You will not be allowed into heaven. Go home, please. Here, you will encounter trouble. Thank you for your attention. Goodbye.
Facebook banned Azov from its platform in 2019, but the decision was reversed the day Russia launched its invasion. Despite its links to far-right groups, the unit received backing from Ukraine's interior minister in 2014, as the government had recognized that its own military was too weak to fend off pro-Russian separatists alone. It played a key role in recapturing Mariupol in June 2014, and, since its integration into Ukraine's official military, the regiment has become more mainstream. The unit was heavily involved in training civilians in the run-up to Russia's invasion. And in recent weeks, the battalion has been the main fighting force in the besieged cities of Mariupol and Kharkiv. The Azov battalion leaders understand that they have a neo-Nazi image problem. Leaders have denied the association between their emblems and Nazi Germany, saying the N and I here mean national idea.
The next two propaganda narratives are two of the most famous and egregious incidents or situations of the entire war. What they have in common is the seeming obviousness to the question of cui bono, yet, contrary to logic, rational thought, and contradictory evidence, the narrative ploys about the nuclear power plant at Zaporizhia and the Russian-German undersea gas pipeline project known as Nord Stream 2 continue to blame the Russian side for whatever is reprehensible in the situation. The nuclear power plant at Zaporizhia on the Dnieper has been occupied, controlled, and operated by Russian military and civilian personnel using much of its pre-war workforce since early in the conflict. For almost as long, the plant has been periodically fired upon with artillery by the other side. This means that the Ukrainian version has Russian forces shelling a nuclear power complex that it currently occupies. Similarly, in brazenness at least, the initial reactions and media explanations for the undersea sabotage of the Nord Stream 2 Russo-German pipeline project sought to blame Russia for the deed, including the horrible environmental damage from the release of the stored-up gas. How possibly could Russia benefit from the destruction of its industrial and commercial infrastructure was unexplained, except in its most simplistic binary formula, whereby all evil and all crimes are the faults of the Russians. Time constraints limit our discussion of the Nord Stream 2 story, but listeners can find veteran and eminent investigative journalist Seymour Hersh's expose at his own Substack webpage. It's called How America Took Out the Nord Stream Pipeline, and first appeared February 8th this year. Another ploy we'll examine is a more recent explosive narrative involving a supposedly Russian government campaign to steal Ukrainian children. A report by Jeremy Lofredo and Max Blumenthal, published on the Gray Zone website March 31st, exposing this propaganda campaign opens thus. The International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for Russian President Vladimir Putin, accusing him of the unlawful deportation of Ukrainian children to a network of camps inside Russia. The warrant was based on a report by the Yale University HRL Center, which is funded by the U.S. State Department. Here is Jeremy Lofredo summarizing his article on the Gray Zone's YouTube channel in an audio segment called Inside a Russian Youth Camp Condemned by the ICC.
The International Criminal Court in The Hague has issued an arrest warrant for Russian President Vladimir Putin.
The basis of the arrest warrant is not alleged crimes or atrocities that have been committed by Russian forces on the battlefield, but instead the alleged deportation and movement of Ukrainian children. the ICC's arrest warrant was based on and supposedly corroborated by a recent report done by Yale University's Humanitarian Research Lab, a lab funded by the U.S. State Department's Bureau of Conflict and Stabilization Operations, which was set up by the U.S. last year to assist in the prosecution of Russian officials. The Yale report alleged that Russia's federal government is operating a large-scale, systematic network of camps and other facilities that has held at least 6,000 children from Ukraine within Russia-occupied Crimea and mainland Russia during the past year. These bold claims, which led to an International Criminal Court arrest warrant, were based on, according to the Yale lab, quote, open-source research, where zero interviews with actual victims were conducted, and the researchers didn't even attempt to see any of the camps in person. In order to translate and analyze their intelligence, according to the report, they used Google. They also admit deep within their report that, quote, many children taken to camps are sent with the consent of their parents and for an agreed duration of days or weeks and returned to their parents as originally scheduled. But besides getting contradicted by their own report, they are also contradicted by evidence from the ground in Russia. The Yale researchers and the International Criminal Court are probably under the impression that no Western journalist has been to these so-called re-education camps, but that assumption would be wrong. I visited one of these camps 4 months ago, unaware that it would be so important to future war propaganda. In November, I was on assignment for Rebel News in Moscow. Mostly, I was doing streeters, seeing what regular Russian people thought about the war. But after meeting someone whose wife was pretty important on the Russian music scene, and after introducing myself, I was invited to an old Soviet-era hotel in Pokrovsky. It turns out it was one of these so-called camps or schools that prompted allegations of kidnapping, abduction, re-education, and eventually, an ICC arrest warrant. Funded by the Russian government, this hotel was turned into a makeshift sleepaway camp for children from Donetsk and Lugansk who were interested in the musical arts and whose parents wanted them away from the front lines. They called it the Donbass Express. I was able to look around and speak to children and teachers. For all of its serious flaws and lack of on-the-ground corroboration, Yale's State Department report does get one thing right about the experiences of these children. The children and their families will keep the fact that they were brought to the Donbass Express secret, because coming here to escape the war and safely play piano with other children would be seen by Ukraine as collaborating with the enemy. The report states, quote, many families in Ukraine do not want to publicly share their camp or school experiences because they fear they will be seen by Ukraine as collaborators with Russia. And that fear is justified.
Finally, and probably most importantly, propaganda and the unknown and half-truths associated with the so-called fog of war invariably surround the reality of fluid military combat operations. Many basic questions, including truthful counts of casualties, materiel losses, status readiness, and even morale, often remain closely guarded secrets. In the case of this conflict, from the perspective of the Ukrainian people, soldiers, workers, and the middle classes, this war has been an unmitigated disaster. The military's losses are reported in the hundreds of thousands of both dead and wounded, many so badly wounded as to never return to active duty. Emigration totals are estimated in excess of 10 million out of roughly 35 million in population before the beginning of the war last February. And the largest battle of the war thus far involving the defense of and fall of the western Donetsk town of Bakhmut shows that both sides continue to dispute even verifiable facts, such as which side prevailed there, presumably because public opinion about the war continues to be a major preoccupation of U.S., NATO, and Ukrainian governments. Retired U.S. Army Colonel, Ph.D. in International Relations, and military strategist and author Douglas McGregor has emerged during this conflict on some mainstream and mostly alternative media because of his gimlet-eyed stare at the hard truths surrounding purely military questions as well as geopolitical ones. He overtly advises, in many of his media appearances as well as writings, that American policymakers of the Biden administration change course to seemingly more rational, mature, and amicable attitudes towards Russia, China, and other U.S. adversaries. At the same time, he often despairs at the unlikelihood of this change of perspective, given the realities of the American state, its bureaucratic inertia, its corruptions, and the ulterior motives of the human personnel involved. Here, Colonel McGregor discusses with Norwegian professor Glenn Deason some of the propaganda as well as truths surrounding the recently concluded Battle of Bakhmut.
Starting in, I would say, late November, early December, given Zelensky's clear obsession with this city of Bakhmut in Ukraine, that Sorovikin, the general who has commanded most of the operations in the theater, made the decision to turn Bakhmut into a kind of Stalingrad and exploit the opportunity to kill as many Ukrainian troops as possible. Remember, the purpose of the operation from the very beginning was to destroy or kill the Ukrainian army. I mean, this is the whole business of denazification. You want to destroy the armed force on your border that threatens your country. And that's what the intervention is all about. It has never been about the conquest of Ukraine, per se, but the destruction of the enemy. So the enemy was very obliging and poured tens of thousands of troops in relentlessly. We think that at least 50,000 Ukrainian troops were killed, at least that many or more wounded. So the operation from a Russian standpoint has been brilliantly successful. And very recently, you had an attack by the Russians near Kiev of this Ukrainian military intelligence headquarters. And I guess it was a Kinzhal missile or an Iskander tactical ballistic missile, because it had at least a 1,000-pound warhead on it. And it was very accurate, very precise, and killed lots of people, not just the ones who were in the building, but actually penetrated into the bunker beneath. Now, this was a signal to the Ukrainians by the Russians that we know where everyone is, because Putin has been talking about decision-making centers. You know, he said, where are the decision-making centers? He said, well, we know where they are, and we've been talking about attacking them. Once again, indicating that I think Putin has approached this carefully, cautiously, and incrementally, because he has not wanted to provoke Western intervention in Western Ukraine. So instead of taking out a sledgehammer and smashing instantly, he's taken out multiple smaller hammers. And it's had the same effect of killing Ukrainian forces. But this was a message that he was sending, saying, look, we know where you are, and we'll hit all these places. And by the way, the Russians are not running out of missiles. This is all nonsense. So the Ukrainians are in for a tough time, and he would like to negotiate an end to this thing. He's made that clear from the beginning. But there's been no willingness in the West, particularly in Washington and London, to talk.
As Colonel McGregor says, Putin would like to negotiate an end to this conflict, as he has said from the beginning. So what of solutions to this war? The U.S., NATO, and the Zelensky government insist that no peace will be made until all Ukraine is liberated from the Russian government. This seems a blustering, propagandistic pipe dream, but its unlikelihood could continue to mean escalation of the conflict by NATO until there literally is a formal war between NATO and Russia, a war that, given NATO's poor state of preparedness, might compel it to use nuclear weapons to stave off a Russian victory. On the contrary, it seems clear that Russia is not going to allow a hostile Ukrainian government to remain in power post-war, only to have to defend its interests and populations in some future war after Ukraine's government reconstitutes its future as a NATO member with additional military forces. This will certainly be a point of contention, but it's important to point out that unless Ukraine yields soon, its very existence may be put to the test. If there's any kind of just solution to this conflict, it may involve Ukrainian workers, soldiers, and political leaders turning the tables, and guns as well, around on their own rulers and bosses to make peace via revolution that proclaims its opposition to Ukrainian capitalists and oligarchs, their fascist henchmen, and U.S.-NATO imperialism. That possibility remains remote at this time, but we will continue to monitor events both large and small in this monumental conflict. For Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, this is Thomas O'Rourke in Washington.
And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Paulina Vasiliev. Thanks for listening.